Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, this week we must begin with the fallout from one of the most sobering and somber events of our lifetimes, the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, since we last did a podcast.
You know, sadly, we've had a lot of these incidents, these mass shootings, these mass killings. We've had Aurora, we've had Columbine.
Fort Hood.
Exactly.
Oak Creek, Wisconsin.
Well, you know, just name it and claim it. We keep doing every time. Everybody says, this is horrific, something must change. We talk about it for a long time. We twiddle our thumbs and either come out with a commission or say, you know, soon we're going to make a decision. The president's going to show leadership. And ultimately, what happens?
Well, you're sounding a little bit there like the president himself, who, when he came out on Sunday night to address the memorial service in Newtown, Connecticut, had this to say, among other things.
If there's even one step we can take to save another child, or another parent, or another town from the grief that's visited Tucson and Aurora and Oak Creek and Newtown, in communities from Columbine to Blacksburg before that, then surely we have an obligation to try.
And since that moving speech the president gave on Sunday night in Newtown, there has been much more from the president. The promise of a new task force that is supposed to come back with recommendations for executive orders and laws.
That was Wednesday of this week. And, you know, every time I hear the word task force, I say, okay, here we go again.
Another commission.
Just nothing will happen. But there is something about seeing a coffin built for a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old that I don't know what's going to change, because remember, you know, during the presidential debate, Obama and Romney were both asked about guns and gun control. And I think the president's first answer was, you know, I'm a strong defender of the Second Amendment.
Right. And he really has, in his first term, done nothing, really nothing to change the gun laws.
And perhaps it's all about Democrats fearful of both what happened in 1994.
When they passed the
assault weapons ban and a lot of Democrats went down to defeat. And 2000, when Al Gore lost in states like West Virginia, perhaps because of guns. I mean, who knows?
There were other issues.
But there were other coal, exactly. But the Democrats have been, this is not, of course, not a pun, but shell-shocked. They're gun-shy, and they're shell-shocked, which is, in many ways, an appropriate term for the cowardice that's been about changing here. And it's not just Republicans. I mean, Harry Reid, when he campaigned for re-election in 2010, I am a strong gun supporter.
He has
been. I love guns.
Right. No, this is the dominant political culture of our country, is that the Republicans are almost lockstep NRA supporters. There have been a few exceptions, Richard Lugar and so on, and, you know, Mike Bloomberg, when he was a Republican, he's a big supporter of gun control. But by and large, the Republican Party is hugely supportive of the Second Amendment, and the Democratic Party is right behind them. So that makes it all the more amazing to see the effect of this Connecticut shooting, as opposed to all the others, where people essentially got real quiet for a long time and then basically went about their business. This time has been different. Will it change the law ultimately?
Well, I agree with you. This has been different. I think we've talked about it more seriously about than ever before, and referring back to the previous horrors, saying, you know, we've sat and let this happen. Enough is enough. But we should announce that we're doing this podcast on Wednesday. We should note that in the days since the tragedy, the NRA has been completely silent. They took down their Facebook page. They have not allowed any of their officials to come out.
Not even
be
a tweet.
Interviewed. No, not even that. But we know that on Friday there'll be some kind of statement. Now, are they going to say it's time to reinstate the assault weapons ban? Of course not.
No, they don't believe in that.
I mean, if we're talking about is legislation to increase mental health programs, well, that wouldn't have stopped Newtown anyway, because it was the son of a woman who legally owned the guns who committed this horror. So I don't know what, I mean, again, am I hopeful right now? I guess I kind of feel that because everybody's talking about it, which we hadn't done in the past. But ultimately, what changes? I don't know.
Well, there are people who are saying that we need to go back to the limits on ammunition.
Right.
And when you can't have 30 or 40 or 60 rounds in one clip so that you can continuously fire for 10 minutes, that sort of thing. Limitations around the edges without threatening the individual's right to bear arms. That kind of thing, I think, will be seriously discussed. I think we also will talk about mental health, maybe not in the standpoint of how that would magically keep the guns away from mentally disturbed people, but just in terms of promoting mental health, generally speaking, and taking it more seriously in insurance laws, taking it more seriously in government programs, really looking at some of these conditions and saying, is there some way we can be more serious about helping these people and preventing them from going off the table in this fashion?
I mean, we know where Dianne Feinstein and Frank Lautenberg stand, and we know where a lot of conservative Republicans stand. I'm fascinated by many of the Democrats, such as Kay Hagan of North Carolina.
Joe Manchin of West Virginia.
Yeah, but the people who were up in 2014, the Kay Hagans, the Mark Udalls, Mark Begich in Alaska, where they stand, because they ultimately are the ones, if there's any shift in this country, certainly if there's any shift in this Congress, we're going to see it with these pro-gun Democrats who heretofore have been unwilling to stand up to the NRA.
I do think Joe Manchin, although he was just reelected and has 6 years ahead, I do think his shift was notable because
he's been such an outstanding... But he's backed off a little bit since then.
Backed off a little bit since, but what I'm saying is there is a new atmosphere. There's a new language.
Agreed.
There's a new conversation. And just the fact that the NRA could be silenced for that long suggests that they think so too, and they're trying to choose exactly when they want to get back into the debate. So here's a question. Was there enough of a paradigm shift because of this event that we changed the atmosphere in Washington enough to actually affect other issues besides gun control, besides violence? For example, the fiscal cliff.
Well, I know that the president, when he spoke on Wednesday, he tried to combine the two, that we have to be willing to compromise, and it includes guns and it includes fiscal cliff negotiations. To me, that was a stretch. I think that trying to combine it, I understand what he was trying to do, and obviously he does have polls in his favor on both guns and the debate negotiations.
At least for the moment.
Right, but again, I don't know what the Republican Party is doing in response. Of course, Speaker Boehner's plan B to talk about incomes over $1 million a year, which, by the way, used to be a Democratic argument. I mean, the Democrats.
The Democrats for a while were saying, why not a millionaire's tax, which is part of the reason he came up with this.
Right.
He said, look at Chuck Schumer. He proposed this. Nancy Pelosi proposed this. Why do you suddenly not want it? Well, of course, they always wanted to make it lower than that. Now they have the opportunity to do so. They're not going to settle for only taxing people over $1 million. The thing, too, that's ironic, though, about Boehner suddenly supporting a higher tax for millionaires, he's going to lose a lot of Republicans on the principle that they shouldn't be raising taxes on anyone. And if job creators are the people we're trying to protect, people over $1 million, theoretically, those are the job creators, aren't they?
Well, exactly. And the vote is scheduled for Thursday in the House. Senator Orrin Hatch, who's the ranking Republican on Senate Finance, said, I'm not going to vote for it. I'm not going to support. Look, my whole life I'm being against increasing taxes, whether it's $250,000 or $1 million, I'm opposed to it. So I don't even know.
It has no chance in the Senate.
Well,
not even going to be considered,
right?
In
we know
the Senate.
That.
So the
right.
President doesn't even have to veto it. It's just an exercise in making somebody feel better in the House before they come right back to having to consider whether they're going to vote for the deal with the president or not.
And once upon a time, it seemed like there was some kind of movement that even though the outward political statements were obligatory sops to their base, we thought that Boehner and the president were getting a little closer. It doesn't sound like it this week.
No. In fact, the most recent thing we've heard from Boehner, well, sounded like this.
Republicans continue to work toward avoiding the fiscal cliff. The president's offer of $1.3 trillion in revenues and $850 billion in spending reductions fails to meet the test that the president promised the American people, a balanced approach. And I hope the president will get serious soon about providing and working with us on a balanced approach.
Of course, we have less than 2 weeks to go before this magical fiscal cliff. Do we go over it or not? We don't know that. We do know, as I said before, that we know that the president seems to be in charge, at least as far as public opinion.
He has the high ground. He has more leverage. The polls seem to be with him.
And not only that, he was actually reelected president of the United States this week.
That's right. Tremendous momentum. Most people thought of that as a November win, but it wasn't.
No,
it was this week.
This is it. When the electors, according to the 12th Amendment, they all in their respective states, some of them not too respective, and the District of Columbia.
Which is totally not respective.
Exactly. And they of course, we'll hear it officially announced in early January, but
the suspense is overwhelming.
It is.
How do you think it went?
Well,
did we get any exit polls from the electors walking out of their state capitals?
I say Gary Johnson wins.
Oh, yes.
No. Actually, I spoke to Karl Rove. Romney won Ohio, and that's all that matters.
That's, no, actually, I thought Karl Rove was insisting it was Bush big.
No, actually, Karl Rove was against Wade Goodwin. You know about that. You know the Rove versus Wade discussion.
Okay. You know, the 12th has always been one of my favorite amendments. Could you tell us a little bit about its provisions?
Yes. It allows blacks to vote.
No, that's not the 12th.
It's not?
No.
No. I plead the 12th.
All right. What you're trying to say is that by the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, we now have the Electoral College that meets on December 17th, and they do elect the president, and we expect that barring something very, very surprising, the president received 332 electoral votes this past Monday, and Mitt Romney 206, which by my math would be about a 3-2 win for the president.
You need 270 to be elected, and of course the president surpasses that with 332, and so it is official. And also this week, the president was named Person of the Year by Time Magazine.
Okay, now what does that mean anymore? There was a time when whoever was the Time Man of the Year, actually, I know, of course, it was always a man in right. those days, but you know, that was a big deal, or at least it seemed like a big deal. Maybe it was never a big deal.
Ron, weekly magazines, and I say it W-E-E-K-L-Y, weekly magazines like Time and Newsweek were a big deal once upon a time. They no longer are. We need up-to-the-minute instantaneous news.
It should be actually like the person of the last minute. Clearly, Time, you know, had another cover made up for Mitt Romney. Had he won the election, he would have been Person of the Year. But it was the president. So you have this kind of lingering momentum. And also the president has been rising in his approval rating since the election. He's actually doing better now than he has at any time since the first few months of his presidency.
Although his national security team has not been doing as well.
All right. Interestingly enough, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has taken two falls in the last week or so.
Yes, that's true. The official one, of course, is the Independent Commission by Thomas Pickering. And
former ambassador.
Right, and Mike Mullen, the former Joint Chiefs of Staff chair.
Very, very high, distinguished group of people.
Who came out with a report that the State Department was insufficiently prepared for protecting the consulate in Benghazi that led to the deaths of four Americans, including the ambassador, on September 11th. And, of course, by inference, Hillary Clinton, the head of the State Department, got the brunt of the blame. Now, she has taken responsibility for everything. The State Department will implement these proposals. But, of course, she was also supposed to testify this week about Benghazi.
And she will not do that.
Because she was ill, she fainted, and she suffered a concussion.
She had a stomach virus. Right? She was dehydrated.
Right?
She got dizzy.
Right?
And she fell down.
Fainted, hit her head, got a concussion, and the worst part is that there are some in the conservative community who are convinced this is just an excuse, a fake excuse, to not to testify.
Well, it depends on what the definition of concussion is.
Where is the doctor's note? I'm serious. It's like
no,
a birth certificate.
Where is the evidence that she went to a hospital, saw a doctor, got a diagnosis of concussion? And, of course, it does seem rather convenient. Now, several other members of the State Department's upper echelon officialdom have taken the fall, resigned.
They've resigned, right.
They've resigned because of the criticism in this report. So it's pretty serious business. But it would appear that since she's not going to be available to testify, and since she will soon be leaving the Secretary of State's office anyway by her own choice, Hillary Clinton does not appear to be, let us say, permanently stamped with this Benghazi incident, at least not to the degree that she might have been had she been more directly the target of this report or been forced to testify in person.
By all accounts, it seems like she will still have to testify in some capacity.
At some point.
Before she resigns.
All right, but what when the iron is considerably less hot?
Yes, and following that, I suspect even sooner than a testifying would be the naming, finally, of John Kerry as Secretary of State.
Why do you say finally? I mean, Hillary Clinton's still in the job. She hasn't even officially left it yet, so.
First of all, we had the Susan Rice and concurrent John Kerry trial balloons going on for weeks. Mm-hmm. We saw what happened to Susan Rice last week. And the Republicans, if they stay true to their word, there will be no battle for John Kerry for Secretary of State. And we could talk about how that opens up a Senate race once again.
Right, which is one reason for them not to object. I think the main reason is they think John Kerry is a pretty reasonable choice for Secretary of State.
And they
like him.
And they didn't like Susan Rice.
He's a senator. Yeah. And they were making it clear that they would make a big stink about Susan Rice, so they don't really want to look like they're just making a big stink about whomever the president chooses.
But, you know, saying that Kerry has a very good chance because he's formerly one of the club, but Chuck Hagel, also formerly of the club, a former Republican senator from Nebraska, he seems to be, again, the potential Secretary of Defense when Leon Panetta leaves, there seems to be mounting opposition to his nomination.
But that's particularly connected to the positions he has taken at times or the things he has said in the past that did not seem sufficiently supportive of the State of Israel. Is that not correct?
Well, I think you can go even further than that. He was against the sanctions on Iran. He refused to name Hamas or Hezbollah as terrorist groups. And he also talked about the Jewish lobby, not the Israeli lobby, the Jewish lobby. And
are those two separate lobbies, or are they this one lobby and the same?
Well, there are folks like the Anti-Defamation League who say that is just a code word, and that you could have easily said the Israeli lobby, but by making it a Jewish lobby, it sounded like an old
throwback to anti-Semitism.
Exactly, exactly. And there's also personal things, just as it was with Susan.
You don't think the fact that his name is Hegel is hurting him in that regard, do you?
And Locke's. No, but but there's also, just as there was with Susan Rice, there's personal things, too. The fact is Chuck Hagel endorsed Barack Obama over John McCain in 2008. McCain, of course, has not forgotten that.
No, it's funny how people remember
And Hagel took on President Bush over the surge in the Iraqi war and was one of the biggest Republican critics of the war. So
all of these things, of course, could be seen as qualifications for why he might be named a Secretary of State by a Democratic president who I believe we noted earlier had been reelected.
When John McCain was reminded this week that Chuck Hagel is a Republican, he said, "You got to be kidding me. He's a Republican? Prove it." I mean, he endorsed Bob Kerry over Deb Fischer in Nebraska.
That is true.
Again, so he's done a lot of non-Republican things, and he can be prickly at times.
All right, so Chuck Hagel, the perfect Republican to be the Secretary of Defense. No, my guess is that if he does not get the job, it will be because of all the reasons you've so eloquently detailed. But I also think there's a chance that he's the kind of Republican that Barack Obama would kind of like to put
in
the job.
I agree.
And that he would, if he became something of a lightning rod for criticism, that would be not entirely unacceptable to the White House. They have a somewhat slippery relationship with the military in general, with the Department of Defense. But there's that other issue lurking out there in the woods, which is, don't the Republicans kind of want John Kerry out of the Senate so they can get Scott Brown back?
Well, first of all, I don't think Scott Brown will win a special election. I think the Democrats were completely caught flat-footed when he beat Martha Coakley in 2010.
And she was not the world's greatest candidate.
No, she was not.
But
and a Republican had no business winning in Massachusetts after a gazillion years of Kennedy and Kerry and all that. So I don't think the Democrats will allow themselves to get caught flat-footed as they were in 2010.
All right, they're not going to nominate Coakley again, but do they have somebody that they can unite behind? Do they have a candidate they're sure is their champion at this point?
Well, they have many members of the congressional delegation who want it.
50, 60.
Exactly. And that's why I kind of think that for all the arguments you can make why Scott Brown won January 2010, I don't think he wins in a special. Before we should talk about the confirmation odds about John Kerry or Chuck Hagel, we do know that there are two changes coming in the Senate.
Yes. The first one we're going to get is Tim Scott, who was just named this week by South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. And he will be taking the place of South Carolina's Jim DeMint, who has stepped down to become or stepped aside to become the president of the Heritage Foundation.
Or stepped up, exactly. But that happens next month. That vacancy happens next month. And, of course, Tim Scott, coincidentally, is African-American. And I say coincidentally in quotes because there's no question that whether he was the right candidate or not, you cannot overstate the symbolism of naming Tim Scott African-American Republican. You usually don't see those two words back-to-back.
He would have been the only black Republican in the new House. Now he'll be the only black member of the United States
Democrat
Senate.
Or Republican.
Correct.
First black Republican senator since Ed Brooke, and of course the first black senator from the South since Reconstruction.
Of either party.
Right.
All right, that's an interesting development in South Carolina. We also have an interesting development in Hawaii, where two women are going to be moving from their House seats into the Senate. In one case, because Mazie Hirono was just elected to that seat where Danny Akaka retired in Hawaii. And then this week, we say goodbye to Daniel Inouye, who was the senior member of the Senate, the second longest serving senator in history.
History, after Robert Byrd.
Died at the age of 88, and his seat is probably going to go to the other Hawaiian member of Congress who has been serving, and her name?
Colleen Hanabusa, the other member of Congress. Interesting, she was first elected to the House in 2010. She is now the longest-serving member of the Hawaii congressional delegation. When you think of Daniel Inouye, 50 years, Daniel Akaka, 22 years, and yet we've lost all that seniority in just a blink of an eye. If we had more time, we would talk more about Daniel Inouye. first Japanese-American ever elected to the House, the Senate, a World War II veteran, which we don't see much of anymore for obvious reasons.
A whole generation is passing.
And a gentleman, an absolute gentleman. He was somebody who worked with Republicans, but he was beloved back home, and he probably would have served forever, and he was an amazing guy, well-respected. In one of his last acts, he sent a note to Governor Neil Abercrombie and said, I want my successor to be Colleen Hanabusa.
Amazing that he was prescient in that sense. And they say his last word before he died was, aloha. One other notable death this week, Robert H. Bork, who was nominated for the United States Supreme Court by Ronald Reagan in 1987 and seemed at first to be an automatic sort of confirmation, as most all of other Ronald Reagan nominees were for the Supreme Court. And instead, he became the center of a firestorm. The Democrats really dug in against him. They fought against him. They campaigned against him. And in the end, there were 58 votes against his confirmation, and he never served on the Supreme Court.
You know, we think about how much the Democrats and Republicans can't get along in the Senate and the Congress. A lot of people go back to that 1987 confirmation fight, which was divisive, partisan, and very ugly. Ted Kennedy standing up in the Senate that in Robert Bork's world, there would be no blacks allowed at the inn. There'd be no women allowed in the Constitution. It was very personal. It was very ideological. And as you say, it was defeated 58-42 with some Republicans voting against him. Robert Bork later became very influential in conservative terms. But that 1987 confirmation fight, in many ways, foreshadowed the partisanship and the bickering and the lack of comity that we see between Democrats and Republicans today.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Brackton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.